It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up later this hour, we'll learn why Americans are getting nearly 60% of their daily calories from ultra-processed foods and what we can do about it.
First, we're looking at yesterday's deadly terrorist attacks in Belgium through a political lens. Yesterday morning, there were three explosions in Brussels, two at the airport, one at the metro station, close to the political center of the European Union. At least 31 people were killed and scores were injured. The Syria-based terrorist organization ISIS released a statement claiming responsibility for the attacks.
U.S. presidential candidates on the left and the right are responding to the attacks and making public statements. Here's a clip of Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in a phone interview with the Today Show yesterday in the immediate aftermath of the attacks.
Terrorists are trying to undermine the democratic values that are at the root of our way of life. We cannot let them succeed. So we have to, intensify our efforts to keep America safe and to work with our friends and allies.
Lily Gorin joins us now to talk about the political fallout of the terrorist attacks. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
Sure. So we just heard Hillary Clinton pledging to work with friends and allies. What else has she said about these attacks?
She has said basically that she made a 3-point plan that she articulated this afternoon in a speech, I believe, where she's talking about, essentially continuing the efforts in Iraq and Syria to take back the sort of space that ISIS has taken over there. She's talked about collaborating in intelligence with our allies. To some degree, perhaps ratcheting up a bit more some of the things that the Obama administration is already doing with regard to the threat from ISIS.
In celebrating her win in Arizona last night, Clinton also said at a rally there that the last thing we need are leaders who incite more fear.
In the face of terror, America doesn't panic. We don't build walls or turn our backs on our allies. We can't throw out everything we know about what works and what doesn't and start torturing people. What Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and others are suggesting is not only wrong, it's dangerous.
So is Hillary Clinton using comments and statements like that maybe to solidify her support among Democrats who might otherwise be supporting Bernie Sanders?
I mean, I think that she's playing to, a lot of the things that she sees and that her campaign is profiling as her strengths, that, she does have a lot of experience dealing with allies, that she has, that she was in the Senate on a number of committees that dealt with issues around terrorism. She was in New York at the time of the 9/11 bombings, that she was Secretary of State and so forth. And so she's articulating through some of her pronouncements and her speeches that, this is the trajectory that she would follow. It's substantially different in at least, the broad contours from what Bernie Sanders has also said.
So in situations like this, where there is an international crisis, international violence, do voters tend to then value more heavily experience that people have, like Hillary Clinton having been a Secretary of State and serving in the Senate?
I think some voters do and some voters don't. I mean, part of it is also what is being articulated by other candidates. And so you have somebody like Donald Trump who may have dealt with foreign entities or foreign leaders, but he hasn't dealt with them particularly in a national security context. But there's a lot of appeal in terms of what he says to a lot of the folks who are supporting Donald Trump, who look at Hillary Clinton and don't think perhaps that she would be tough enough.
And we will move on, certainly, to talk about Donald Trump and the people that are also running for the Republican nomination. But has Bernie Sanders said anything specific about these terror attacks that differentiate him from candidate Clinton?
Well, I think what Sanders did, I think, quickly say yesterday was that, you know, we are at war, and we are not at war, but we are in a conflict with radicalism, with terrorism, but that we are not in a conflict with a religion. And to characterize it as such is what he said was essentially inappropriate or incorrect.
So let's move to the Republican side and to what businessman Donald Trump and Texas Senator Ted Cruz have said after the attacks. Here's a clip of Donald Trump from the Today Show just after the attacks. He's responding to a question about whom he would let in the country now.
Well, I would exclude the people coming in from Syria that don't have documentation, coming in from the migration line, that interestingly have cell phones in many cases. But you say, how did they get the cell phones and where do they get their bills paid? I would certainly exclude those people from coming in.
So Donald Trump has been making consistently throughout his campaign comments about Muslims and allowing Muslims into the country. In the wake of attacks like Brussels, do you think that those views might be seen as more socially acceptable, given that there is now this event that can be pointed to?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's the voters to whom he was appealing or making his appeal in the first place who, in all the polls that I've seen, have a much higher degree of interest in or willingness to exclude people from the country or exclude specifically Muslims from the country, not even specifically Syrians, but Muslims in general. And those, you know, that sort of there's the folks who are looking at Donald Trump as their candidate, that sort of assertion and argument is one that's very appealing to his base of voters.
Now, Donald Trump has also said that he would torture terrorist suspects to try and get information that he thinks would allow him as president to keep the nation safer. Does that help him as a candidate, especially in the wake of newer attacks?
It may. Again, the issue of torture is one that is controversial, and it's controversial also across party lines. John McCain has spent a lot of time in the Senate advocating and, you know, pushing for legislation that would prohibit the use of torture. And he was critical of the George W. Bush administration with regard to it. So I think that, again, there isn't sort of broad-based we should torture or we shouldn't torture. But I think that, again, Trump is appealing to or trying to sort of argue for a position that, you know, is strong and decisive. And the lines are very clearly marked out in the way that he's making his statement. You know, we won't allow Syrians in that don't have documentation, that have cell phones or who have cell phones. We won't allow Muslims in who aren't U.S. citizens. That there's a lot of sort of bright lines and clarity with regard to what he's saying that is not always executable with regard to policy in conjunction with the United States Constitution.
We're talking with political scientist Lily Gorin now about the political fallout of yesterday morning's terrorist attacks in Brussels and how those attacks might affect the U.S. presidential race later this year.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What would you like to hear the candidates say in response to these terrorist attacks? And which candidate do you think would be the best one to handle a situation like this? And what do you think about how the presidential candidates are reacting to the situation in Brussels? Call now at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation now about how the terrorist attacks yesterday morning in Brussels will affect the presidential race later this year.
And we'd like to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about what the candidates are saying or not saying about yesterday's attacks? What would you like to hear them say in order to maybe win over your vote? And which candidate do you think is best suited to handle a situation like the one yesterday in Belgium? How do you think the U.S. should respond, if at all? Call now, 800-642-1234, or you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. While making our way through the Republican candidates, Ted Cruz said that we have to empower law enforcement to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized. What do you make of that comment, Lily Gorin?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how you do that without some substantial profiling, and the New York Police Department has responded that this isn't really the way of going about things. John Kasich, who's also running for the Republican nomination, has, you know, criticized Ted Cruz for this sort of assertion yesterday. And when I myself heard it, I was kind of perplexed by exactly what would constitute a Muslim neighborhood.
And so do you think that Cruz is trying to ramp up his rhetoric to match Trump, since it seems, at least on some level, to be resonating for Trump?
I mean, I guess in some capacity he is. I mean, he's sort of taken a path that is, you know, more defining Ted Cruz than it is sort of taking on Donald Trump throughout the campaign. He hasn't necessarily got into a lot of clashes with Trump. He's just sort of argued that he's, a conservative, and he's more traditionally conservative, and that he has a clear sort of ideology that he's following. But I do think that in this context, he and Trump in particular are making pretty sort of bold statements with regard to, you know, sort of Fortress America.
So Ted Cruz has also made comments that are critical of Donald Trump's response to these attacks, specifically accusing Trump of wanting the U.S. to pull out of NATO. Why do you think Cruz is taking that approach in criticizing Donald Trump?
Again, he's probably trying to distinguish himself in terms of, you know, that Cruz would be, presidential, and that in a certain sense, if Trump is threatening to, you know, change our alliances, particularly longstanding ones like NATO that came out of the Cold War, that doesn't necessarily reflect the United States as a superpower and the military strength that we have.
So there is John Kasich, Ohio governor, and the third Republican candidate still running. And he also had something to say.
You know, we are not at war with Islam. We're at war with radical Islam. We're going to need to have a coalition of people, both Arab Muslims, who are going to join the coalition to destroy ISIS.
And so John Kasich has at times really struggled to kind of get the same level of attention and media coverage that his two rivals have been getting. Why do you think he's taking this particular position?
Well, I think it's probably one that he agrees with. I mean, I given that he came out and criticized Ted Cruz for what he said with regard to patrolling Muslim neighborhoods, that Kasich is defining himself to some degree in the vein of somebody like George W. Bush or George Herbert Walker Bush, is a Republican president who is making alliances with our international partners, that sort of understand the sort of multidimensional nature of this kind of threat. And he's right to, you know, sort of point to the fact that in order to defeat ISIS, it can't just be European countries and the United States. It also has to be Americans' allies in the Middle East, who are, in fact, Arabs and Muslims, to help defeat this radicalized group.
We have Lynn in Milwaukee on the line, so let's go to the phone. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because the whole question of today's show sort of makes me sad. We just look at this tragedy through our own self-centered, narcissistic American lens. Like, how does it affect us? How does this tragedy, you know, the loss of so many lives, the devastation, the security of a nation, so many people affected so brutally and so personally, and we look at it through our lens of, well, how does this affect our presidential campaigns at the moment? It just makes me a little bit sad that we're thinking in terms of how does it affect us. I'd rather think about how it's affecting, how ISIS is affecting Europe and the people in Europe, not to say that we shouldn't be concerned for our own selves, of course.
Thanks for that call, Lynn. And Lily, is it because of the U.S. stature on the international stage that things like this really do play out in our presidential campaigns and elections?
Yes, I mean, part of it is, as you know, the caller mentioned, that we have a tendency to pay attention to what we're in the midst of, and we in the United States are in the midst of this very tumultuous presidential election. But, you know, even you on Wisconsin Public Radio, you all did a show yesterday that was on, you know, sort of what happened on the ground, what was going on in Europe, what's the situation in Belgium. And so the fact that all of the presidential candidates in the United States had something to say about the attack in Belgium also brings it into the campaign itself. And it does start to define the sort of decisions or potential decisions that one of these people who will likely be the next president of the United States is sort of good to know what they're also thinking in response to these kinds of attacks.
So these attacks happened certainly not at the beginning of the presidential primary season, but we still do have contests on both sides for the Republicans and the Democrats. Do you think that on some level, Lily, this is getting talked about more and people are being judged on what they're saying about these attacks because we are still in the primary? Would it be different if it happened closer to the general election?
Oh, I think that if it happened during the general election, it would again be a question of how the candidates respond, what they propose that they would do in reaction to this. I mean, you can look back at you know, like the economic downturn in 2008 and what both John McCain and Barack Obama as candidates at the time were asked and said specifically with regard to the economic implosion that transpired in September and October before the general, you know, before the election in November. So I think that regardless of when it happens, it still becomes a question of also how you evaluate the candidates and their decisions. What, you know, what would somebody who is, you know, President Clinton or President Cruz, what would they do in response to a terrorist attack either in the United States or in, you know, in a country where we have allies or in places that we don't even pay quite as much attention to? You know, there have been these bombings in Ankara, Turkey recently too.
And President Obama has been making the case that his strategy against ISIS is slowly working. Do you think the attacks yesterday in Belgium negate that argument or make it harder for him to make it?
Well, I mean, it's a multi-pronged approach, and it's also one where, you know, the United States is not necessarily sort of saying, well, we've killed these many people or we've eliminated this kind of threat, as all of the candidates and particularly the presidents, both W. Bush and Obama, have said since 9/11, this is a war where you don't know when you're going to win it exactly. And it morphs into a variety of different sort of zones. And so his approach has been to, you know, sort of go after the terrorists where they have the most strength, which is in Syria and Iraq. But it's also to collaborate with our allies in terms of intelligence in Europe and in the United States to try to prevent these kinds of attacks. But the next move in the Middle East would be to have a substantial ground force. And all of the polls that I've seen of late, there isn't all that much support in the United States for a lot of U.S. soldiers to go into Iraq and Syria to try to defeat ISIS on the ground.
So President Obama is less than a year out from being done with his tenure as president. Do you think that because he is not having to worry about whether he'll be elected for another term and his vice president isn't running, if he can kind of stay the course that he has laid out for dealing with ISIS and other threats of terrorism despite these attacks. Whereas maybe if he was running for re-election, he might feel like he would have to ramp up his anti-terrorism platform.
I don't know that it necessarily would be distinct from what he's done as president or what he did in his first term. I mean, this is both one of the assets and one of the sort of perpetual critiques with regard to Barack Obama is that he is kind of this, you know, much more cerebral and also to some degree patient in a certain sense with regard to this policy. And, you know, John McCain and Lindsey Graham were calling yesterday for ground troops, a big allocation of ground troops to go into Syria and Iraq on this. We have been having these, you know, bombing campaigns for quite some time that have taken out, I think, over 10,000 ISIS enemies. But again, it's sort of like there isn't necessarily more bombing that could be done without it necessarily hitting a lot more civilians. And so that's the Obama administration's approach. And I'm not necessarily sure if they would change it at this point. Because it's doing what they think they need to do. But again, I don't know that that would necessarily change if he were running for re-election, because this is the same approach that he's laid out sort of as he was a candidate as well.
Lily, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure.
That was Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, talking about the presidential candidate's responses to the terrorist attacks. A recent study shows that Americans are getting nearly 60% of their daily calories from ultra-processed foods, which has some nutritionists worried.
According to the medical journal BMJ Open, these ultra-processed foods include frozen pizzas, breakfast cereals, and other products that include high amounts of added sugar, coloring, and artificial flavors.
Researchers at BMJ say the more ultra-processed foods a person eats, the more they're likely to eat too much sugar, which can lead to diabetes and other health problems down the road.
For more on this study and the current American diet, we're joined by Marion Nessel. She is a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health and a professor of sociology at New York University. Her latest book is called Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Marion, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, glad to be there.
Well, why are Americans getting so many calories from these ultra-processed foods, according to this new study?
Well, first of all, ultra-processed foods are a fancy way of saying junk foods. Everybody knows what they are. They're foods that no longer resemble the plants that they came from. And we've known for a long time that they're high in calories, they're high in added salt, sugar, and fat. If you want to eat healthfully, you eat fruits and vegetables and things that haven't been nearly as processed as those. So in a sense, this isn't really new information. People who eat healthfully tend to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. Those aren't ultra-processed.
So you don't think we're seeing a big spike in people eating these processed food? This has been a presence for a while, it sounds like.
It's a presence for a while, but it's you know, we have a class-based dietary intake system in the United States where people who have money and education are eating very healthfully, and they're going to farmers markets and buying at grocery stores and going to the outside aisles and buying real foods and cooking them or, you know, having them cooked. And people who are poor can't do that. So they're the ones who are eating the foods that are cheapest. Because of government policy, junk foods are cheaper than healthier foods. It's one of the great ironies of our American food system right now.
And they're also a lot faster to eat. If you're having to grab dinner on the go, it's probably, you know, fast food is just that. It's fast. Whereas if you have to steam some broccoli or something, that's a time investment.
Yes, and it also involves dirtying a pot, which is going to have to be washed, and somebody had to go to the supermarket and buy it. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why cooking, especially if you don't have the talent to do it or haven't learned how to do it. We're not teaching cooking in junior high school anymore. I learned how to cook in the eighth grade in a home economics class where they started out with cookies. I just loved it.
And, you know, sugar is one of the issues here that nutrition experts are most concerned with in terms of junk food. Do we have a grasp, do you think, the general person on the street, how much added sugar our food has?
Oh, I don't think anybody has a clue, because most of it's hidden. When you think about sugar, you think about what's in the sugar bowl, and you know how much you're adding to whatever it is you're eating from that sugar bowl. What you don't see are the sugars that have been put into the foods that you're buying processed or from restaurants or wherever, and everything. I mean, we like sweet. Sweet is delicious, and everything is sweet these days.
And, you know, one thing that surprised me about this study by BMJ is that they were including things like cheese and bread in the definition of ultra-processed food. Should we be on the lookout for that, too, along with the sugar?
Well, I don't know. I happen to think that bread is staff of life, and to me, there's nothing better than a really great piece of bread. And I'm so happy that there are so many people who are baking wonderful bread these days.
No, I'm with you.
So I think some exceptions have to be made. And we're not talking about eating everything. You know, I'm not much for denial when it comes to food. I love to eat. I think food is one of life's greatest pleasures. And what's difficult is that Americans don't do moderation very well. It's not in our DNA. So I think bread is great. A lot of bread is probably not so great because it's got calories, if nothing else.
We're talking right now with nutrition expert Marion Nessel. She's from New York University, talking about the American diet and ultra-processed foods. A new study found that Americans were getting 60% of our daily calories from ultra-processed food. So you talked about this, Marion, from an economic standpoint, that it's not an even playing field when it comes to food. So how do we go about changing that equation and making healthy food more accessible to everybody?
Yeah, it's not a level playing field, and I'm just astounded by Department of Commerce figures on the relative prices of fruits and of unprocessed fruits and vegetables and junk foods since about 1980, and it shows that the cost, the relative cost of fruits and vegetables has gone up by something like 40%, whereas the cost of these other kinds of foods has gone down. And that has a lot to do with federal policies that support the production and consumption of some foods more than others. If we want to change that, we have to change the farm bill. Oh, my goodness. That's a formidable task.
What's going on in the farm bill?
Well, the farm bill supports industrial agriculture more than it supports fruits and vegetables, which have historically been considered to be specialty crops. They go under the heading of horticulture. In the farm bill, they're not taken seriously. They get token support in comparison to corn, soybeans, and the other commodities that are the basis of highly processed foods. So that requires a change in legislation. It requires a change in the way that we think about these things and a linking of agriculture to health policy, which has not happened historically in this country, although I think a lot of people are working toward that.
Well, looking at that from the political angle that you were just talking about, the author of the study noted that it seems like Americans purchase far more ultra-processed foods than Canadians or people in the United Kingdom. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it has to do with marketing. There's much more marketing of those foods in this country. And the amount of marketing that goes, I mean, what you have to understand is how extraordinarily profitable these foods are to the companies that make them. They can buy the ingredients at very low cost and store them. The products are shelf-stable for very, very long periods of time. In fact, there's a big issue right now about even keeping them on the shelf longer, so less of these products is wasted. So you have this situation where they're cheap to produce, they last for a long time, and they can be sold at a wonderful premium, even though it doesn't seem like the prices are very high. The volume is so great that many, many such products are billion-dollar-a-year sellers. And the amount of money that goes into the marketing of these products is extraordinary. You know, the food industry spends about $17 billion a year on marketing, and that's just the amount of marketing that goes through advertising agencies. That includes food products, restaurants, and alcohol. So it's everything, but the numbers are staggering.
Well, whenever studies like this come out, and they seem to come out pretty regularly, I mean, the knee-jerk response, I think, is sort of shame. Like, oh my gosh, Americans are terrible at this. Look at how our place in the world. We should be ashamed of ourselves. Or maybe finger-pointing. You know, those people are not eating healthfully. What is a better response, do you think?
A better response would be to look at the food marketing system and say, how can we change it to make it better, to make it easier for people of any income level to eat healthfully, and to be able to enjoy their food and eat what they like and do all of those other things that wealthy people can do. And that's what I think the food movement is about. I don't know anybody who's involved in the food movement who doesn't care a lot about extending the availability of healthy foods to everybody in the country and making that, you know, part of our American democracy is to have a democratic food system as well as everything else.
Well, I think about the movement kind of spearheaded by Michael Pollan, that farmers market movement, buying local, eating in the fresh foods aisle on the sides of the grocery store, not the processed in the middle. And it seems as though there is a sort of rising food consciousness. Is it reaching all strata of the various economic classes, or is it just staying localized?
Yeah, not yet. Not yet, but as I said, I mean, the food movement sector of the population is quite small. It may be 10 to 15% of the population, but it's growing quite rapidly, and most important, it's growing among young people. And I see this because at NYU, where I teach, we started programs in food studies in 1996. They're now heading into their 20th anniversary. And when we started food studies, nobody was in it. Everybody thought we were crazy. Who would want to study about food? And now I've just come back from Ohio University, which has a terrific new program in food studies. There are food studies programs in every university that I visit. That means that young people are being taught about how the food system works and what to do to make it better.
We're talking with Marion Nessel right now from New York University. She's the author of Taking on Big Soda or Soda Politics. And we want you to join the conversation about the American diet and ultra-processed foods.
Have you noticed that you're eating more of these ultra-processed foods like cereal or snacks or frozen pizza? Do you find it hard to avoid these foods? Or do you avoid them as much as possible? And if so, how? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with nutrition expert and author Marion Nessel right now about the rise of ultra-processed foods in the American diet, and we want to hear from you.
Have you noticed that you're eating more of these ultra-processed foods like breakfast cereal, snacks, or frozen pizza? Is it challenging to eat a healthy meal that's also fast? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Bill joining us from Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hi, Veronica. I know you had just asked about whether or not this wholesome food movement was able to get to all sectors of the economy. And I thought I would let you know about a program in Milwaukee. You know, the Fondy Market in Milwaukee, an urban market in Central City, has been in the leadership of bringing electronic benefit transfer to farmers market so that people might be able to bring their food stamps card or Quest card to the farmers market and use it there, as well as WIC benefits. So the more that we can make these kind of benefits available to people who use what you conventionally call food stamps, you know, the more they're having good food accessible. So it's a nice movement that Fondy is actually bringing it to other farmers markets here in Milwaukee and hopefully in a greater reach.
And Bill, are you seeing that being effective so far, do you think?
Yeah, they had either doubled or tripled their use of food stamps over the last 2 years even. So they're, and I think they're one of the lead organizations in the state. So the more that, and part, of course, is engaging people in being aware that you can use the card there. So there's an educational campaign that goes along with that as well.
Bill, thanks a lot for that. And Marion, what do you think about that as one approach?
Well, it's national. It's national. It's wonderful that it's working so well in that area, but it's a national program. It's funded by the Farm Bill and or privately. It's both of them are involved in it, and there was money in the 2014 Farm Bill to double up the amount of value that food stamp participants would have if they bought at farmers markets, but it affects a very, very small percentage. It's growing, but it's got a long way to go.
Well, would you support broadening efforts like that, making them?
Absolutely. I mean, the real problem is that most farmers markets aren't in low income areas. They're often in high income areas, and when they are, as the caller said, they must be accompanied by some kind of outreach program that welcomes people in the community into the farmers market. So that they will actually use the benefits that are available.
Well, Bill, appreciate you calling up and telling us about that. And we'll go next to Vivian in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi. Observations, younger family, well, grandparents and younger adults with grandchildren across the street, a lot of processed food over there. And I think it has to do with education. The other thing is, I'm 70. My children and I really stay away from processed food. My daughter's on top of nutrition, and she's changing the way I eat. But a friend of mine in her 80s, her church ladies group sat around, talked about the sugar in milk. Did you know there's sugar in milk? And that makes milk bad. And they're not getting that there's natural sugar in milk. There's natural sugar in apples. And now they're just in a panic because sugar is in everything instead of realizing that it can be an additive or it can be there naturally. So I think education is going to have to play a huge part in this.
Vivian, appreciate that call. And Marion, what do we need to do better at health and nutrition literacy?
Well, it's a problem, and that was the caller made a really important point, and that's the difference between natural and added sugars. Nobody's worried about the sugar in natural that occur in grapes or fruit or, for heaven's sakes, milk. I mean, that's there. It's there to make it taste good. Sugar makes things taste good. Sugar is delicious. I love sugar. The trick is moderation and to avoid as much added sugar as possible, and by added sugar, we mean the amount that the manufacturer is putting in to these processed foods. Now, I think the FDA's new labeling requirements will help a lot. The FDA has proposed to put added sugar on food labels, and the rumors that I hear is that that's going to go through. I don't have any hard information about it, but I've been hearing rumors that that's likely to stick. And when the FDA finally comes out with the new food label, it'll have added sugars on it, and that may help if people read labels.
Marion, sugar is sort of the big boogeyman in nutrition these days and in the way we think about nutrition and in popular culture, too. It used to be carbs. Now it seems like it's sugar, too. Is it warranted that we're placing this much emphasis on sugar, or do you think a broader approach would be more effective?
Yeah, I actually am a calorie person myself. I worry about calories more than anything else. And I think that the rise in prevalence of obesity can easily be explained by the fact that people are eating more now than we did in the 1980s because portion sizes are bigger. I mean, I don't really think that it takes anything more complicated than that to explain it. But people like simple explanations. They like them a lot, and there are a lot of scientists and a lot of lay people who think that sugar is poison and that, you know, if you just cut your sugar, you will solve all of your nutritional problems. I think cutting sugar would probably help because sugar has calories and no nutrients, and you want to get nutrients in the food that you're eating. But I don't think it's going to solve the problem unless people make some other lifestyle changes as well, one of which is to eat foods that are less processed.
Marion, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Mary Nessel is a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. She's written several books, including Why Calories Count and Food Politics. We're talking there about ultra-processed foods in the American diet and how to avoid them.